Side 17. Ilium by Dan Simmons. Continuing on page 529. The huge sphere to the west flattened to a circle in the sky, and then sank until the Martian Ocean was level with the Mediterranean Sea. Water surged back and forth between the two worlds. The Achaean ships tried to drop their sails. Men quit rowing, but the high-beaked ships could not stop in time, and sailed through the circle of boiling turbulence into the Martian Northern Ocean, with white-sloped Olympus Mons looming in the background. No matter which direction Monmouth looked, he could see the Martian volcano, even through the spheres now resolving themselves into circular portals high in the sky over Ilium. "What's going on?" shouted Orfu over the tight beam. "Huh?" said Monmouth again. Scores of black flying objects hurtled through the circular portals in the sky. Out of the circle, slicing into the sea behind Monmouth, even through the ground-level portal, more arch now than circle since its base was under Trojan soil, opening less than 100 meters in front of Achilles and Hector and his men. The flying objects threw themselves through the sky like giant hornets, and Monmouth noticed that they were black, barbed, sharp-planed, not much larger than Orfu, and powered by visible pulse engines in their bellies, sides, and sterns. The machines had bulbous, black-glassed cockpits and were festooned with whip-com antennae and what looked to be weapons, missiles, guns, bombs, ray projectors. If these were new-generation chariots from the gods, they'd gone high-tech industrial in a hurry.
"Monmouth!" bellowed Orfu.
"Sorry," said the little Moravec. Almost stuttering, he hurried to describe the chaos in the skies, seas, and fields around them. He had trouble catching up to real time.
"What are Achilles and Hector and all the other Greeks and Trojans doing?" asked Orful. "Running?"
"Some are," said Monmouth, "but most of the Achaeans around me and the Trojans near your ridge are running into the closest circle portal."
"Running into it?" repeated Orful of Io.
Monmouth had never heard his big friend sound flabbergasted before.
"Yeah. Achilles and Hector started it. They shouted, bellowed something, held their spears and shields high, and just, well, rushed into it. I guess they see Olympus Mons and know what it is and just attacked."
"Attacked a Martian volcano?" repeated Orfu.
He sounded even more thunderstruck.
"Attacked Olympus, the home of the gods," said Monmouth, sounding pretty stupefied himself. "Oh, my."
"What, oh, my?" demanded Orfu.
"The circle portal thing behind us," stammered Monmouth. "Dozens of Greek ships went through it."
"Yeah, you said that."
"But there are hundreds of ships visible through the portal."
"Greek ships?" asked the Ionian.
"No," said Monmouth. "Most of them are LGM ships."
"Little green men?"
Orfu sounded like a poorly engineered voice synthesis device, sounding each word out as if he'd never heard it before.
"Thousands of LGM on hundreds of ships."
"Valakas?" said Orfu.
"Valakas, those big barges they use to transport the stones for heads. Larger sailing ships, smaller ships, they're all sailing toward Olympus Mons, mixed in with the Achaean ships now."
"Why?" asked Orfu. "Why are the Zeks sailing toward Olympus?"
"Don't ask me," shouted Monmouth. "I just work here. Uh-oh."
"Uh-oh?"
"The sky's full of fiery streaks now, like meteors flaming down from space."
"The gods resuming their bombardment?" asked Orfu.
"I don't know."
"Which direction?"
"What?" said Monmouth. If he had been designed with a jaw, it would be dropping now. The sky was a latticework of fiery streaks, with the circular portals showing Olympus Mons in a dozen places around Ilium, and the sky filled with black barbed machines jetting back and forth at increasingly lower altitudes. Thousands more Achaeans and Trojans had rushed into the first portal after Achilles and Hector, while tens of thousands more Trojans and their allies were taking up defensive positions on the walls of Ilium and on the plain just outside the Scaean gates.
Gongs rang out, drums beat.
The air sizzled with energy and echoed with roars. Achaeans ran to defensive positions on their trenches, sunlight glinting on polished armor. 1,000 Trojan archers on the Ilium ramparts went to full pull on their bows, arrows aimed skyward. A score more of black ships put out to sea from the Achaean camp. Monmouth couldn't pivot fast enough to take it all in.
"Which direction are the meteor trails going?" said Orfu. "West to east, east to west, north to south?"
What the hell does it matter which direction? Snapped Monmouth. No, wait, sorry. They're coming from all parts of the sky, making crosshatches against the blue.
Any of them heading for Ilium? Asked Orfu.
I don't think so, not directly. Wait, I can see something at the end of one of those trails now. I'm zooming in. Good heavens, it's a...
Spaceship? Said Orfu.
Yes, breathed Monmouth. Fins?
Hull?
Roaring engine? It looks like a cartoon of a spaceship, Orfu. It's hovering on a column of yellow energy. The other meteors are also ships. Some hovering, one coming down. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh again, said Orfu.
That hovering spaceship appears to be landing, said Monmouth. So are four or five of the smaller black flying machines.
Yes, said Orfu.
The Ionian sounded calm, perhaps even amused. They're landing on the ridge near you. Almost right on top of you, Orfu. Stay put, I'm coming.
Monmouth began running on all fours at top speed for the ridge where the yellow spacecraft exhaust was kicking dust and small rocks 100 feet into the air. He couldn't see Orfu through the dust as the various machines set down next to the Amazon's tomb. The barbed flying machines were extending a complicated tripod landing gear. The weapons on the landing Hornet ships were swiveling, targeting Orfu. Monmouth saw this just before he lost sight of everything as he galloped into the dust storm.
I'm not going anywhere, sent Orfu. But don't sprain a servo mechanism hurrying, old friend. I think I know who these guys are.
60. The Equatorial Ring. Rolling in the terrace darkness with Caliban, it felt to Demon as if the monster were trying to tear his arm off. Indeed, the monster was trying to tear Demon's arm off. Only the metallic fibers in the therm skin and the suit's automatic response to seal all rends kept Caliban's teeth from ripping the meat off Demon's arm and then tearing the bones one from the other. But the suit wouldn't save Demon for much longer. The man and man-beast crashed into tables, rolled among post-human corpses, bounced off a girder and rebounded in microgravity from a glass wall. Caliban would not release his grip and hugged Demon tightly to him with long fingers and prehensile webbed toes. Suddenly the creature relaxed its bite, pulled its slavering head back, and lunged for Demon's neck again. Demon blocked the lunge with his right forearm again, was bitten to the bone again, and moaned aloud as they bounced back to the terrace railing. In spite of the suit's automatic closing, blood jetted out in discrete spheres, bursting on impact with Demon's suit or Caliban's scaly hide. For a second, they were wedged against the terrace railing, and Demon was staring into Caliban's yellow eyes, only inches from his own. He knew that if his punctured forearm wasn't in the way, Caliban would bite through his osmosis mask and rip his face off in a second. But what really passed through Demon's mind at this moment was a simple phrase and an astounding fact. I'm not afraid. There was no infirmary standing by to fax his dead body away and fix it in 48 hours or less. No blue worms waiting for Demon now. Whatever happened next was forever. I am not afraid. Demon saw the animal ears, the slavering muzzle, the scaly shoulders. And he thought again how physical and fleshy Caliban was. He remembered from the grotto the obscene pink of the animal thing's bare scrotum and penis. As Caliban pulled his teeth free to lunge again, even while Demon knew that he couldn't block the lunge toward his jugular a third time, the man reached down with his free left hand, found yielding globes, and squeezed as hard as he'd ever squeezed anything in his life. Instead of lunging, the monster jerked its head far back, roared so loudly into the thin air that the noise echoed in the almost airless space, and then the beast struggled to break away. Demon ducked low, shifted both hands lower, his right arm bled, but the fingers on that hand still worked, and squeezed again, hanging on and being dragged behind as Caliban writhed and kicked to break free. Demon imagined pulping tomatoes with his powerful hands, his human hands. He imagined squeezing the juice out of oranges, of bursting pulp, and he hung on. The world had receded to the will to hang on and squeeze. And Caliban roared again, swung his long arm and struck Demon hard enough to send him flying. For several seconds, Demon was not conscious enough to defend himself or even to know where he was. But the creature did not use those seconds.
He was too busy flailing and howling and holding himself, his scaly knees flying high as Caliban tried to crouch and hunch in midair. Just as Demon's vision began to clear, he saw the monster flail his way back to the terrace, grab the railing, and fling himself the 15 feet between him and Demon. The long arms and claws were already halfway to him. Demon groped blindly amidst the chairs and tables around him, found his iron pipe where it had bounced, lifted it to his shoulder with both hands, and savagely swung the metal into the side of Caliban's head. The sound was most satisfying. Caliban's head snapped aside, and his flailing arms and tumbling torso crashed into Demon. But the man flung the beast to one side, feeling his own right arm going numb now, and he dropped the pipe, leaped for the terrace railing, and then kicked up toward the semi-permeable exit 30 feet above. Too slow. More used to the low gravity powered by hate now beyond human measurement, Caliban used hands, feet, legs, and momentum to rebound off the terrace wall, catch the railing with his toes, crouch, spring, and beat Demon through the air to the marked panel above them. Seeing that he wouldn't win the race to the glass, Demon grabbed a girder protruding 15 feet from below the marked panel and arrested his movement. Caliban landed on the ledge, arms out, blocking the approach to the white square. Demon saw that there was no way that he could get around or past those wide arms, those raking claws. He suddenly felt the pain from his torn and punctured arm hitting his mind and torso like an electric shock. Then felt the growing numbness there as warning of the weakness and shock that must soon follow. Caliban threw his head back, roared again, showed his teeth, and chanted, "What I hate, he consecrates. What I ate, he celebrates. No mate for thee, more meat for me." Caliban was ready to spring after Demon as soon as the human turned to flee. Seeing the raw scars on Caliban's chest, Demon found himself smiling grimly. Savi hurt him with her shot. She didn't die without a fight. Turning to flee, Demon pulled himself horizontal on the girder, squatted, gathered his remaining energy in his legs, put his head down, and launched himself straight at Caliban's chest. It took Demon 2 or 3 seconds to cross the space between them, but for an instant the monster seemed too surprised to react. Food was not supposed to act in this impertinent manner. Prey was not supposed to charge. Then the creature realized that his dinner was coming to him, wearing the therm skin he desired, and Caliban showed all of his teeth in a smile that became a snarl. The beast threw his arms and legs around the incoming human in a grip that Demon knew the monster would not release until the man was dead and half-eaten. They went through the membrane together, Demon feeling the sensation of tearing through a curtain of sticky gauze, Caliban bellowing into thin air 1 second and into cold silence the next. Together they tumbled into outer space, Demon hugging Caliban as fiercely as the monster was clutching Demon, the human's left hand pressed up against the monster's underjaw, trying to keep those teeth away for the 8 or 10 seconds he thought he needed. The thermskin suit reacted immediately to vacuum, tightening fiercely into Demon's flesh, constricting until it acted as a pressure suit, sealing off even molecular gaps that would bleed air or blood or heat into space. The osmosis mask inflated the clear visor and switched the movement and purification of the man's recycled breath to 100%. Cooling tubules in the therm skin let Demon's natural sweat flow quickly through channels, cooling his sunward side even as body heat was transferred to the part of his body in -200 degrees shadow. All this happened in a fraction of a second, and Demon did not even notice. He was too busy thrusting Caliban's jaw and muzzle upward, keeping those teeth away from his throat and shoulder. Caliban was too strong. He shook his head, freed it from Demon's weakening pressure, and then threw open his mouth to bellow before ripping the man's throat out. Air rushed out of Caliban's chest and mouth like water from a punctured gourd. Saliva froze even as it spewed into space. Caliban clapped his long-fingered hands over his ears, but not in time. Blood globules spewed into space as the creature's eardrums exploded. The blobs of blood began to boil in vacuum, and barely more than a second later, the blood in Caliban's veins began to boil as well. Caliban's eyes started to swell, and more blood spurted from his tear ducts. His muzzle moved up and down as his mouth worked like a fish's,
wheezing silently in vacuum, gasping for air, but no air came. The surface of Caliban's bulging eyes began to freeze over in cloud white. Demon had wrenched himself free, tumbled across the outside terrace, almost floated helplessly off into space, but caught the metal mesh railing, then hauled himself hand over hand to where the familiar Sony was tethered to the metal surface. He didn't want to run. He didn't want to turn his back on Caliban. He wanted to stay and kill the thrashing monster with his gloved hands. But one of those hands wasn't working now. His torn right arm now hung useless as he kicked the final 10 feet to the low vehicle. Harmon. Hannah. A human would be dead by now, unprotected in space, knowing so little about anything. Demon instinctively knew that. But Caliban was not human. Spewing blood and frozen air like some horrible comet boiling away its own surface as it approached the sun, Caliban tumbled, flailed, found purchase on the gridded metal of the terrace, and kicked his way back through the semi-permeable wall, back into air and relative warmth. Demon was too busy to watch. Pulling himself down prone into the driver's cushions, he turned his gaze to the metal shelf where the virtual control panel should be. It was off. How do I activate it? What do I do if I can? How did Savi start it up? Demon's mind was blank. His vision narrowed as black dots danced in his field of view. He was hyperventilating and close to passing out as he worked frantically to recall the image of Savi flying the Sony, activating the controls. He couldn't remember. Calm down, easy, easy. It was his voice, but not his, an older voice, steady, amused. Take it easy. He did, forcing first his breathing back to a sane rate, then willing his heartbeat to slow, then focusing his vision and his mind. Didn't she use some voice command? That wouldn't work here in space. No air, no sound. Savi had told them that. Or perhaps Harmon had. Demon was learning from everyone these days. How then? He forced himself to relax a step further and then closed his eyes and tried to recall the image of Savi flying them all away from the iceberg that first night flight. She passed one hand under this low cowl near the hand grip to activate things. Demon moved his left hand. A virtual control panel flashed into existence. Able to use only his left hand, closing his eyes when he had to remember more clearly, Demon moved his fingers through control sequences on the multicolored virtual panel. The force field flicked on and pressed him down against the cushions. A second later, a roar startled Demon into looking up, but it was only air flooding into the secured space, just as he'd commanded with his fingers. With the air came a voice. Manual or autopilot mode? Demon tugged his osmosis mask up a bit, almost wept as he breathed in the first sweet air he'd tasted in a month, and said, Manual. The control grip flicked into place, surrounded by a virtual aura. The stick felt solid in Demon's left hand. Forgetting the tie-downs until he saw the elastic bands rip free and fly into space, Demon lifted the Sony 10 feet above the metal terrace, twitched the stick, fed power to the rear thrusters, went off course, quickly realigned before smashing into metal instead of window, and hit the semi-permeable square doing 30 or 40 miles per hour. Caliban was waiting on the ledge inside. The monster leaped for Demon's head, and his trajectory was perfect. But the force field was on. Caliban bounced off and tumbled into the empty air at the center of the tower. Demon made a wide turn, getting used to the steering, twisted the control stick to add more power. The Sony was doing 60 or 70 miles per hour when Caliban looked up. The beast's bleeding eyes went wide, and the bow of the Sony plowed into the monster's midsection, sending him flying across the open tower space and crashing into girders and glass on the far side. Demon would have loved to stay and play. The want of it ached more in him than the screaming pain from his right arm. But his friends were dying below. He banked the Sony and dived straight down toward the city floor more than 90 stories below. He almost didn't pull up in time. The Sony sheared turf, cut through kelp, and sent dead grass flying. But then Demon got the thing flying level and cut back on the speed a bit. His 20-minute flailing trip from the infirmary took him 3 minutes on the flight back. The entrance wall was not quite wide enough for the Sony.
Demon backed the hovering machine up, gave it more throttle, and made the semi-permeable entrance permanently permeable. Shards of glass and metal and plastic followed the Sony as Demon flew it between dark, empty healing tanks. He winced as he caught a glimpse in some of those tanks of the dead white bodies of those humans they hadn't saved in time. Then he was stopping the Sony, killing the force field and jumping out next to two more bodies on the floor. Armin had left the blue thermskin suit on Hannah, keeping only the osmosis mask for himself in the final minutes. The man's naked body looked bruised and pale in the reflected light from the Sony's headlights. Hannah's mouth was open wide, as if in a final, futile effort to force more air into her lungs. Demon didn't waste time to see if they were alive. Using only his left arm, he scooped each of them up and laid them in the two couches on either side of his own. He paused only to jump out again, throw Savi's pack in the back couch, and to toss the gun onto the armrest of his own couch before he was back in place and activating the force field. "Pure oxygen," he said to the Sony as the air rush began. The clean, cold air became thicker, making Demon's head swim, it was so rich. He fumbled in the virtual control panel, setting off several caution alarms before finding the heat. Warm air radiated from the console in various vents. Armin began coughing first, then Hannah a few seconds later. Their eyes flickered, opened, finally focused. Demon grinned stupidly at them.
Where?
Gasped Armin. "Take it easy," said Demon, slowly moving the Sony toward the fermery exit.
"Take your time." "Time? The time," gasped the older man. "The linear. Accelerator."
"Oh, fuck," said Demon. He'd forgotten about the onrushing structure, never once looked up or over his shoulder in space to see it coming. Demon twisted the Sony's throttle full open, slammed through the hole where the membrane had been, and accelerated toward the tower exit. There was no sign of Caliban in the tower. Demon slewed a wide curve, threaded the needle through the tower exit pane, and climbed from the outside terrace into space.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," breathed Tarman.
Hannah screamed, the first sound she'd made since being fished out of the healing tank. The 2-mile-long linear accelerator was so close that the wormhole collection ring at its bow filled 2/3 of the sky above them, blotting out sun and stars. Thrusters were firing in quad pods all along its absurd length, making final course corrections before impact. Demon didn't know the names of everything at that moment, but he could make out every detail of the gleaming cross braces, polished rings now cratered with countless micro-meteorite strikes, racks of cooling coils, the long copper-colored return line above the main accelerator core, the distant injector stacks, and the swirling earth and sea-colored sphere of the captured wormhole itself. The thing grew larger as they watched, blotting out the last of the stars above, and the shadow of it fell across the mile-long crystal city beneath them.
"Demon,"
began Harmon. Demon had already acted, twisting the throttle ring full over and looping up and over the tower, the city, the asteroid, diving for the great blue curve of the Earth even as the linear accelerator covered the last few hundred meters behind them. For an instant, the city towers were above them as the Sony looped, and then just slightly behind when the hurtling mass struck the city and the asteroid, the wormhole sphere crashing into the towers and the long city a second or two before the exotic metal structure of the accelerator itself. The wormhole silently collapsed into itself and the accelerator seemed to accordion neatly into nothing. But then the full force of the impact became apparent as all three of the humans turned in their couches and craned their necks to see behind them. There was no sound. That struck Demon the hardest. The pure silence of the moment. No vibration. None of the usual earthly clues that some great cataclysm was taking place. But taking place it was. The crystal city exploded into millions upon millions of fragments, glowing glass and burning gas expanding outward in all directions. Great ballooning balls of flame bulged outward a mile, 2 miles, 10 miles, as if trying to catch the diving Sony, but then the huge fires seemed to fold inward, like a video image running in reverse, as the flames consumed the last of the escaping oxygen. The city on the opposite side of the asteroid from the impact
was propelled off the surface of the stony worldlet, coming apart in a thousand discrete trajectories as the glass and steel and pulsing exotic materials flew and blew apart, no section celebrating their own separate orgies of destruction, punctuated everywhere with more silent explosions and self-consuming fireballs. A second after the first impact, the entire mile-long asteroid shuddered, sending concentric waves of dust and gas into space after the city debris. Then the asteroid broke apart. "Hurry," said Harmon. Demon didn't know what he was doing. He dived the ship toward Earth at full velocity, staying just ahead of the flames and debris and waves of frozen gases. But now various red and yellow and green alarms were showing all over the virtual control board. Worse than that, there was sound outside the Sony at long last, a suspicious hiss and crackle growing in seconds to a terrifying roar. Worst of all, an orange glow around the edges of the Sony was quickly turning into a sphere of flame and blue electrical plasma. "What's the matter?" shouted Hannah. "Where are we?" Demon ignored her. He didn't know what to do with the throttle and attitude control. The roar rose in volume and the sheath of flames thickened around them. "Are we damaged?" shouted Harmon. Demon shook his head. He didn't think so. He thought perhaps it had something to do with coming back into the Earth's atmosphere at such speed. Once at a friend's house in Paris Crater, when Demon was 6 or 7, despite his mother's admonitions not to do so, he'd slid down a long banister, popped off onto the floor at high speed, and then slid on his bare hands and knees along his mother's friend's thick carpet. It had burned him badly, and he'd never done that again. This friction felt something like that to Demon. He decided not to tell Harmon and Hannah his theory. It sounded a little silly even to himself. "Do something!" shouted Harmon over the roar and crackle all around them. Both men's hair and beards were standing on end in the center of all this electrical madness. Hannah, bald, even her eyebrows gone, stared around her as if she'd awakened to madness. Before the noise drowned out everything else, Demon shouted at the virtual controls, "Autopilot! Engage, autopilot!" The Sony's neutral voice was almost inaudible under the entry roar. Demon could feel the heat through the force field and knew that couldn't be good. "Engage autopilot!" shouted Demon at the top of his lungs. The force field fell in on the three humans, squeezing them tightly to their couches as the Sony flipped upside down and the stern engines fired so fiercely that Demon thought his teeth were going to rattle out of his head. His arm hurt terribly under the deceleration pressure. "Re-enter on pre-programmed flight path?" the Sony asked calmly, speaking like the idiot savant it was. "Yeah!" shouted Demon. His neck was aching from the terrible pressure, and he was sure that his spine was going to snap. "Is that an affirmative?" asked the Sony. "Affirmative!" screamed Demon. More thrusters fired. The Sony seemed to bounce like a thrown rock skipping off a pond's surface, was wrapped twice more in re-entry fire, and then somehow straightened itself out. Demon raised his head. They were flying, flying so high that the edge of the Earth was still curved ahead of them, so high that the mountains far beneath them were visibly mountains only by the white snow texture against the brown and green Earth colors. But flying. There was air out there. Demon cheered, reached over and hugged Hannah in her blue thermskin suit, then cheered again, raising his fist toward the sky in triumph. He froze with his fist and eyes raised. "Oh, shit," he said. "What?" said Harmon, still naked except for the osmosis mask now dangling around his neck. Then the older man looked up, following Demon's gaze. "Oh, shit," he said. The first of 1,000 fireballs, debris from the city or the linear accelerator or the broken asteroid, roared by them less than a mile away, trailing a vertical wake of flame and plasma 10 miles behind it, almost flipping the Sony over with the violence of its passage. More meteors roared down at them from the burning sky above. 61. The Plains of Ilium. Monmouth arrived on the thicket ridge just as 9 tall black figures stepped out of the spacecraft that had landed amidst the Hornet flyers, all 9 striding down the ramp into the swirling dust storm created by their landing. The figures were humanoid by way of insectoid, each about 2 meters tall, each covered with shiny, chitinous duraplast armor, and a helmet that reflected the world around them like polished onyx. The individual's arms and hands reminded Monmouth of images he'd seen of a dung beetle's appendages, painfully curved, hooked, barbed, and blackly thorned. Each carried a complex, multi-barreled weapon of some sort that looked to weigh at least 15 kilograms. The figure in the lead paused in the swirling dust and pointed directly at Monmouth.
"You there, little Moravec. Is this Mars?"
The amplified voice spoke in inter-moon basic English and arrived via both sound and tight beam.
"No," said Monmouth. "It's not. It's supposed to be Mars."
"It's not," said Monmouth, sending all this to Orfu. "It's Earth, I think." The tall, soldierly form shook its helmeted head as if this was an unacceptable answer.
"What kind of Moravec are you, Callistan?"
Monmouth drew himself up to his full bipedal height. "I'm Monmouth from Europa, formerly of the exploration submersible the Dark Lady. This is Orfu of Io."
"Isn't that a hardvac Moravec?"
"Yes."
"What happened to his eyes, sensors, manipulators, and legs? Who cracked his shell like that?"
"We're supposed to report to a Ganymedan named Koras III," said the armored form.
"Take us to him."
"He was destroyed," said Monmouth, "in the line of duty." The tall black figure hesitated. It looked at the other 8 Onyx warriors, and Monmouth had the idea they were conferring via tight beam. The first soldier turned back.
"Take us to the Callistan Repo, then," he ordered.
"Also destroyed," said Monmouth. "And before we go any further, who are you?"
"They're Rockvex," said Orfu on his private tight beam channel.
"Aren't you Rockvex?" the Ionian asked on the common tight beam wavelength. It had been so long since Orfu had communicated with anyone except Monmouth that the smaller Moravec was shocked to hear his voice on the common band.
"We prefer to be called Belt Moravex," said the leader, turning to address Orfu's shell. "We should medevac you to a combat repair center, old-timer."
He gestured to some of the other combat Moravex, and they began moving toward the Ionian.
"Stop!" commanded Orfu, and his voice held enough authority to freeze the tall forms in their booted tracks. "I'll decide when to leave the field, and don't call me old-timer or I'll have your gears for garters. Koras III was in charge of this mission. He's dead. Repo was second in command. He's dead. That leaves Monmouth of Europa and me, Orfu of Io, in command. What's your rank, Rockvec?"
"Centurion leader Mepahu, sir."
"Mep-a-who?" thought Monmouth. "I'm a commander," snapped Orfu. "Is the chain of command clear here, trooper?"
"Yes, sir," said the Rockvec.
"Brief us on why you're here and why you think this is Mars," said Orfu, in the same tone of absolute command.
Monmouth thought his friend's voice on tight beam was dipping into the subsonic. The bass was cracked so deep.
"Immediately, Centurion leader Ahu."
The Rockvec did as he was told, explaining as quickly as he could while more Hornet flyers buzzed overhead and hundreds of Trojan warriors came out of the city and slowly advanced up the ridge toward the landing party, shields raised, spears poised. At the same moment, hundreds more Achaeans and Trojans were flowing through the circular portal a few hundred meters to the south, all of them running toward the icy slopes of Olympus, visible through the slice taken out of the sky and ground. Centurion leader Mepahu was succinct. He confirmed Orfu's earlier statement to Monmouth from their discussion when they'd been passing over the asteroid belt on their way to Mars, that 60 years ago the Ganymedan Koras III had been sent to the belt by the quill-based Moravec Astig Chang and the 5 Moons Consortium. But Koras' mission had been as a diplomat, not as a spy. Spending more than 5 years in the belt, hopping from rock to rock and losing most of his Jovian Moravec support team in the process, Koras had negotiated with the belligerent Rockvec clan leaders, sharing the Jovian space Moravec scientists' concerns about the rapid terraforming of Mars and the early signs of quantum tunneling activity just detected there. The Rockvecs wanted to know who was doing this dangerous QT tunneling. Post-humans from Earth?
Koros 3 and the Beltmorovax agreed on the acronym UMEs, Unknown Martian Entities. The Rockvex were already concerned, although more about the visible and impossible rapid terraforming of Mars than about the quantum activity, which their technology could not easily detect. Confrontational and bold by nature, the Beltmorovax had already dispatched 6 expeditionary fleets of spacecraft on the relatively short hop to Mars. None of their ships had returned or survived translation to Mars orbit. Something on the Red Planet, or on what had been the Red Planet until recently, the Rockvex had no idea what, was destroying their fleets before arrival. Through diplomacy, guile, courage, and some single combat, Koros 3 had earned the Rockvex clan leader's trust. The Ganymedean explained the 5 Moons Consortium's plan. First, the Rockvex would design and biofacture dedicated warrior Vex over the next 50 years or so, using their already tough Rockvex DNA as a breeding base. The Rockvex would also be responsible for designing and constructing advanced space and atmospheric fighting vehicles. Meanwhile, the more advanced 5 Moons Morovex scientists and engineers would divert cutting-edge technology from their interstellar program to the building of a quantum tunneler and wormhole stabilizer of their own. Second, when the time was right and the quantum activity on Mars reached alarming levels, Koros himself would lead a small contingent of Morovex from Jupiter space, its goal to arrive undetected on the Red Planet. Third, once on Mars, Koros 3 would place the quantum tunneler at the vertex of the current QT activity, stabilizing not only those quantum tunnels already in use by the UMEs, but opening new tunnels to the asteroid belt where other 5 Moons designed tunneling devices would be waiting for his maser signal before activating. Fourth, finally, the Rockvex would send their fleets and fighting men through these quantum tunnels to Mars, where they would confront, identify, overpower, subdue, and interrogate the unidentified Martian entities and eliminate the threat to the solar system from the excessive quantum activity. It sounds simple, said Monmouth. Confront, identify, overpower, subdue, and interrogate. But in reality, your group didn't even make it to the right planet. Navigating the quantum tunnels was more complicated than expected, said Centurion leader Mapahu. Our group's obviously connected to one of the UME's existing tunnels and overshot Mars, arriving here. The chitinous onyx figure looked around. His troopers were raising their heavy weapons as 100 or so Trojans came onto the crest of the ridge. Don't shoot at them, said Monmouth. They're our allies. Allies? Said the Rockvex soldier, his shiny visor turned toward the advancing wall of shields and spears. But in the end he nodded, tight-beamed his troopers, and the complex weapons were lowered. The Trojans did not lower their weapons. Luckily, Monmouth recognized the Trojan commander from the long introductions of captains earlier in the day. In Greek, Monmouth called out, Paramus, son of Megas, do not attack. These black fellows are our friends and allies. The spears and shields stayed high. Archers in the second row had their bows lowered, but arrows knocked, and the bows at half pull, ready to lift and fire on command.
The Rockvex might feel secure from meter-long barbed arrows dipped in poison.
But Monmouth didn't want to test the strength of his own integument that way. Friends and allies, mocked Paramus. The man's polished bronze helmet, nose guard, cheek flaps, round eye holes, and low ridge in the back showed only Paramus' angry gaze, narrow lips, and strong chin. How can they be friends and allies, little machine, when they aren't even men? For that matter, little toy, how can you? Monmouth didn't have a good answer for that. He said, You saw me with Hector this morning, son of Megas. I saw you with man-killing Achilles as well, called the Trojan. The archers had raised their bows now, and there were at least 30 arrows aimed at Monmouth and the Rockvex. How do I win this guy's trust, Monmouth tight-beamed Orfu?
Paramus, son of Megas, mused the Ionian. If we'd let things go the way the Iliad said they should, Paramus would be dead in 2 days. Killed by Patroclus, along with Autonomous, Echeclus, Adrestus, Elasis, Mulius, and Pleiartes in one wild melee.
Well,
sent Monmouth. We don't have 2 days. Most of the Trojans you mentioned, Otanoas, Emilius, and the rest, are standing there right now with shields raised and spears poised. And I don't think Patroclus is going to help us out here, according to Hockenberry, unless Achilles' friend has been swimming back from Indiana. Any ideas on what we can do now?
Tell them that the Rock Vex are attendants, forged by Hephaestus and summoned by Achilles to help win the war against the gods.
Attendants, Monmouth said, repeating the word in Greek. I don't know that particular form of the noun. It doesn't mean servant or slave, and...
Just say it, growled Orfu, before Paramus has them put a shaft through your liver.
Monmouth didn't have a liver, but he understood the thrust of Orfu's suggestion.
Paramus, noble son of Megas, called Monmouth. These dark forms are attendants, forged by Hephaestus, but brought here by Achilles to help us win this war against the gods.
Paramus glowered.
Are you then also an attendant? He demanded. Say yes, sent Orfu.
Yes. Paramus barked at his man, and the bows were lowered, the arrows unknocked.
According to Homer, sent Orfu, attendants are a sort of androids created in Hephaestus' forge from human parts and used like robots by the gods and some mortals.
Are you telling me that the Iliad has androids and Moravecs in it? Demanded Monmouth.
The Iliad has everything in it, said Orfu.
To the Rockvec leader, Orfu barked,
Centurion leader Ahu, did you bring force field projectors with you in that ship?
The tall onyx Rockvec clicked to its full height. Yes, Commander.
Send a squad into the city, that city Ilium, and set up a full-strength force field to protect it, ordered Orfu. Set up another to protect the Achaean encampment you see along the coast.
Full-strength field, sir? Asked the Centurion leader. Monmouth knew that it would probably take the spacecraft's entire fusion reactor's output to power such a field.
Full strength, said Orfu. Able to repel lance, laser, maser, ballistic, cruise, nuclear, thermonuclear, neutron, plasma, antimatter, and arrow attack. These are our allies, Centurion leader.
Yes, sir. The onyx figure turned and tight-beamed. A dozen more troopers descended the ramp carrying massive projectors. The dark troopers jogged double time in both directions from the ridge until only Centurion leader Ahu remained there next to Monmouth and Orfu. A landed Hornet flyers buzzed into the air and circled, weapons still swiveling. Paramus walked closer. The crest on the man's polished but battered helmet barely came up to Centurion leader Ahu's chiseled chest. Paramus lifted his fist and rapped on the Rockvex Duroplast breastplate with his knuckles.
Interesting armor, said the Trojan.
He turned back to Monmouth. Little attendant, we're going to go join Hector in the fight.
Do you want to join us?
He pointed to the huge circle bitten out of the sky and ground to the south. More Trojan and Achaean units were marching, not running, but marching in orderly fashion, chariots and shields gleaming, banners flying, through the quantum portal, their spear tips catching Earth's sunlight on this side of the slice, Martian light on the other.
Yes, said Monmouth.
I want to join you. To Orfu he tight-beamed. You going to be okay here, old-timer?
I have Centurion leader Mapahu to protect me, sent the Ionian.
Monmouth marched next to Paramus down the slope. The thickets there trampled almost flat now by 9 years of the ebb and flow of battle, leading the small contingent of Trojans to join Hector. At the bottom of the hill, they paused as an odd figure staggered toward them, a naked, beardless man with mussed hair and slightly wild eyes. He was walking gingerly, picking his way over the stones on bloody feet, and wore only a medallion.
Hockenberry, said Monmouth in English.
He doubted his own visual recognition circuits.
Present and accounted for, grinned the Skolic.
Howdy, Monmouth. In Greek he said,
Good afternoon, Paramus, son of Megas. I'm Hockenberry, son of Dwayne, friend of Hector and Achilles. We met this morning, remember?
Monmouth had never seen a live human being naked before this minute, and he hoped it would be a long, long time until he saw a second one. What happened to you, to your clothes? He asked.
It's a long story, said Hockenberry.
but I bet I could condense it and finish it before we march through that hole in the sky over there. To Paramus, he said, Son of Negus, is there any chance I could get some clothes from your group? Paramus obviously recognized Hockenberry now, and remembered how both Achilles and Hector had deferred to him earlier at their interrupted captain's conference on Thicket Ridge. He turned and snarled at his men, Clothes for this lord! The best cape, the newest sandals, the best armor, the most polished greaves, and the cleanest underwear. Autonomous stepped forward. We don't have any extra clothes or armor or sandals, noble Paramus. Strip and give him your own immediately, bellowed the Trojan commander. But kill the lice first. That's an order.
62. Ardis.
The sky continued to fall all that late afternoon into evening. Ada had rushed out onto Ardis Hall's long lawn to watch the bloody streaks slash the sky. Sonic booms crashing and recrashing across the wooded hills and river valley. And just stood there as the guests and disciples screamed and overturned tables and ran down the road toward the distant Fax Pavilion in their panicked eagerness to escape. Odysseus joined her, and they stood there on the grass, a two-person island of immobility in a sea of chaos.
What is it? Whispered Ada. What's happening?
There were never fewer than a dozen fiery streaks in the sky, and sometimes the evening sky was all but occluded by the meteors.
I'm not sure, said the barbarian.
Does it have something to do with Savi, Harmon, and Demon?
The bearded man in the tunic looked at her.
Perhaps.
Most of the burning trails scorched the sky and disappeared, but now one, brighter than the others and audible, screeching like a thousand fingernails dragged across glass, burned its way to the eastern horizon and struck, throwing up a billowing cloud of flame. A minute later, a terrible sound rolled over them, so much louder and deeper than the fingernail scraping of the meteor's passage, that the rumble made Ada's back teeth ache. And then a violent wind came up, knocking leaves off the ancient elm and tumbling most of the tents that had been set up in the meadow just beyond the driveway turnaround. Ada gripped Odysseus's powerful forearm and clung to it until her fingernails drew blood without her noticing, or Odysseus saying anything.
Do you want to go inside? He said at last.
No.
They watched the aerial display for another hour. Most of the guests had fled, running down the road when they could find no available droshky or carryall or voynix to pull them. But about 70 disciples had stayed, standing with Ada and Odysseus on the sloping yard. Several more objects struck the earth, the last one more violent than the first. All of the windows on Ardis Hall's north side shattered, shards raining down in the evening light.
I'm so glad that Hannah is safe in the infirmary right now, said Ada.
Odysseus looked at her and said nothing. It was the man named Pater who came out of the manor at sunset to tell them that the servitors were down.
What do you mean, down? Demanded Ada.
Down, repeated Pater, on the ground, not working, broken.
Nonsense, said Ada, servitors don't break.
Even with the meteor shower brighter now with the sun setting, she turned her back on the view and led Odysseus and Pater back into Ardis Hall, stepping carefully across the broken glass and shattered plaster. Two servitors were on the floor of the kitchen, one more in the upstairs bedroom. Their communicators were silent, their manipulators limp, the little white-gloved hands dangling. None responded to proddings, commands, or kicks. The three humans went out back and found two more servitors where they had fallen on the yard.
Have you ever seen a servitor fail? Asked Odysseus.
Never, said Ada.
More disciples gathered.
Is this the end of the world? Asked the young woman named Phaene. It wasn't clear who she was addressing.
Finally, Odysseus spoke over the sky roar. It depends on what's falling. He pointed his powerful, stubby finger at the E and P rings just visible behind the meteor storm pyrotechnics. If it's just some of the big accelerators and quantum devices up there, we should survive this. If it's one of the four major asteroids where the posts used to live, well, it could be the end of the world, at least as we know it.
What's an asteroid? Asked Pater, ever the curious disciple.
Odysseus shook his head, waving the question away.
When will we know? Asked Ada.
The older, bearded man sighed. A few hours, almost certainly by tomorrow evening.
I never really thought about the world ending, said Ada, but I certainly never imagined it ending by fire.
No, said Odysseus, if it ends for us, it'll end by ice.
The circle of men and women looked at him.
Nuclear winter, muttered the Greek. If one of those asteroids, or even a big enough chunk of one, hits the ocean or land, it'll throw enough garbage in the atmosphere to drop the test.
Maybe more.
The skies will cloud over, the storm will start as rain, and then turn to snow for months, maybe centuries. This planetary tropical hothouse you've grown accustomed to in the last millennium and a half will become a playground for glaciers.
A smaller meteor ripped low in the northern sky, striking somewhere in the forests there.
The air smelled of smoke, and Ada could see distant flames in all directions. She took a second to think about how unknown this whole world was to her. What was north of Ardis Hall in the forests there? She'd never walked more than a few miles from Ardis or any other fax node, and then always with an escort of Voynichs for protection.
Where are the Voynichs? She asked suddenly.
No one knew. Ada and Odysseus circled Ardis Hall, checked the outer fields and driveway and lower meadow where the Voynichs usually stood waiting or walking perimeter duty. None were there. Nobody in the small group on the lawn remembered seeing any even before the meteor shower began.
You finally frightened them away for good, Ada said to Odysseus, trying to make a joke. He shook his head again. This isn't good.
I thought you didn't like Voynichs, said Ada. You cut one of mine in half your first day here.
They're up to something, said Odysseus. Their time may have come round at last.
What?
Nothing, Ada. He took her hand and patted it. Like a father, thought Ada, and stupidly, shockingly, began to cry. She kept thinking about Harmon, and how confused and angry she'd been when he'd told her he wanted to help her choose him as a father for her child, and how he wanted the child to know that he was the father. What had seemed an absurd idea, almost obscene, now seemed so very, very sensible to Ada. She gripped Odysseus' hand tightly and wept.
Look, cried the girl named Paean.
A less brilliant meteor was descending right toward Ardis, but at a shallower angle than all the others. It still trailed a fiery trail against the darkening sky. The sun had finally set, but this meteor tail looked more like real flames than screaming, heated plasma. The glowing object circled once and seemed to fall out of the sky, crashing with audible impact somewhere beyond the line of trees above the upper meadow.
That was close, said Ada. Her heart was pounding.
That wasn't a meteor, said Odysseus. Stay here, I'm going to walk up there and check it out.
I'm going with you, said Ada. When the bearded man opened his mouth to argue, she said simply, it's my land.
They walked up the hill together into the deepening twilight, the sky above them still alive with silent flame. The flames and smoke were visible just beyond the edge of the upper meadow, just past the line of trees, but Ada and Odysseus didn't have to go searching in the darkness there. Ada saw them first, two bearded, emaciated men walking toward them from the forest. One of the men was naked, skin glowing palely in the dim twilight, ribs visible from 50 feet away, and he appeared to be carrying a bald, blue-suited child in his arms. The other skeletal, bearded man was dressed in what Ada immediately recognized as a green thermskin suit, but the suit itself was so torn and filthy she could barely see the color of the material. This man's right arm hung uselessly at his side, palm forward, and his bare wrist and hand were dull red with blood. Both men were staggering, struggling to stay upright and to keep moving. Odysseus drew his short sword halfway from its scabbard on his belt.
No, cried Ada, pushing Odysseus' hand and sword down.
No, it's Harmon, it's Demon. She ran toward them through the high grass. Harmon started to pitch forward as she approached, and Odysseus sprinted the last 20 paces, catching Harmon's burden as the man fell forward. Demon also went to his knees.
It's Hannah, said Odysseus, laying the semi-conscious young woman in the grass and setting his fingers on her neck to find her pulse.
Hannah? Repeated Ada. This woman had no hair or eyelashes, but the eyes under flickering eyelids were Hannah's.
Hi, Ada, said the girl on the ground. Ada went to one knee and crouched next to the fallen Harmon, helping him roll over onto his back. He tried to smile up at her. Her lover's face was bruised and cut under the whiskers, his cheeks and forehead all but covered with caked blood. His eyes were sunken, skin an unhealthy white, and his cheekbones too sharp above his beard. Harmon shivered with fever, and his eyes burned at her. His teeth chattered when he spoke. "I'm all right, Ada. God, I'm glad to see you." Damon was in worse shape. Ada couldn't believe that these two battered, bloody, emaciated men were the same two who had set forth so casually a month earlier. She put one arm under Demon's arm to keep him from pitching face first into the ground. He swayed on his knees. "Where's Safi?" asked Odysseus. Harmon shook his head sadly. He seemed too tired to speak again. "Caliban," said Demon. His voice sounded 20 years older to Ada's ear. The worst of the meteor storm had abated, the audible impacts and more fiery falls having moved off to the east. A few dozen minor streaks crossed the zenith west to east almost gently, looking more like August's annual Perseid showers than the violence of earlier in the evening. "Let's get them back to the house," said Odysseus. He stood, lifted Hannah easily in both arms, and gave his right shoulder to Demon to lean on as he rose. Ada helped Harmon to his knees and then to his feet, putting his right arm over her shoulder and holding much of his weight as they all headed down the darkened meadow toward the lights of Ardis Hall, where Odysseus' disciples and Ada's friends had lighted candles. "That arm looks bad," Odysseus said to Demon as the four of them and the unconscious girl descended. "I'll cut the therm skin off and take a look at it when we get in the light." Ada used her free hand to reach and gently touch Demon's bloodied arm, and the gaunt man moaned and almost swooned. Only Odysseus' strong shoulder and Ada's right hand slid quickly to the small of his back kept Demon upright. The young man's eyelids fluttered for a few seconds, but then he focused, smiled at her, and kept walking. "These are serious injuries," said Ada, feeling close to tears for the second time that evening. "You should both be faxed to the infirmary." She didn't understand at all when both men started laughing, hesitantly and painfully at first, more coughing than laughing for a moment, but then the barking changing to pure laughter, increasing in volume and sincerity, until the two battered, bearded men sounded almost irritatingly drunk in the throes of their own private amusement. 63. Olympus. Olympus Mons, the tallest volcano on Mars, rises more than 17 miles above the surrounding plains and above the new ocean at its base. The volcano at its base spreads more than 400 miles in diameter. With its green summit peaking above 87,000 feet, Olympus Mons is almost three times the height of Mount Everest on Earth. The sides of the mountain, white from snow and ice in the daytime, are glowing almost blood red this evening from the glare of the setting Martian sun. The ragged cliffs here at the northeast base of Olympus Mons sweep up vertically for 17,000 feet. On this particular Martian evening, the long shadow of the volcano stretches east almost to the line of the three Tharsis volcanoes on the hazy horizon. The high-speed crystal elevator that used to snake its way up this side of Olympus has been sliced in two not far above the cliffs, and sliced as cleanly as if cut by a guillotine. A powerful seven-layer force field generated by Zeus himself, the Aegis, shields the entire Olympus Mons massif from attack, and shimmers now in the red light of evening. Just beyond the cliffs, near where the base of Olympus comes close to the northern ocean terraformed here just a century and a half earlier, a thousand or more gods have come down to gather for war. 100 golden chariots, each powered by invisible forces, but visibly pulled by powerful steeds, fly air cover thousands of feet above the masses of gods and golden armor assembled on the high plains and shingled beaches below. Zeus and Hera are at the forefront of this immortal army, each figure 20 feet tall, husband and wife both resplendent in armor and shields and weapons hammered into shape by Hephaestus and other craft-skilled gods. Even Hera's and Zeus's high helmets are forged of pure gold, laced with microcircuits, and reinforced by advanced alloys.
Athena and Apollo are temporarily missing from the forefront of this divine phalanx, but the other gods and goddesses are here. Aphrodite is here, still beautiful in her war gear. Her war helmet is studded with precious stones. Her tiny bow is made to shoot crystal arrows with hollow tips filled with poison gas. Ares is here, grinning beneath the brow of his red-crested war helmet, happy in anticipation of the unprecedented bloodletting soon to come. He carries Apollo's silver bow and a quiver full of heat-seeking arrows. Any target he shoots at, he will kill or destroy. Poseidon is here, the Earthshaker, huge and darkly powerful, dressed in war gear for the first time in millennia. 10 men, even including Achilles, could not lift the massive axe Poseidon carries in his left hand. Hades is here, darker in countenance, mood, and armor than even Poseidon, his red eyes gleaming from the depths of his battle helmet's deep sockets. Persephone stands by her lord, armored in lapis lazuli, a barbed titanium trident held firm in her long, pale fingers. Hermes is here, thin and deadly, wrapped in his red insect's armor, poised to quantum teleport into battle, kill and leap away before mortal eye can record his arrival, much less the carnage he will leave behind. Thetis is here, her divine eyes red from weeping, but dutifully clad in full-scaled war gear, ready to kill her son Achilles if and when Zeus wills it so. Triton is here, bold in layers of green-black armor. This is the forgotten Satyros of the old worlds, terror of the conch-horn and rapist of girls and boys, the god who took pleasure in discarding children's bodies in the depths after he'd had his pleasure with them. Artemis is here, gold-armored goddess of the hunt, her war bow in her hand, ready and eager to spill gallons of human blood as the first step toward avenging the injury to her beloved brother Apollo. Hephaestus is here, armored in flames and ready to bring the torch to the mortal enemy. All the gods except healing Apollo and healing Athena are here. Row upon row of giant, armored, silent figures drawn up beneath the shadows of the cliffs. Above them, more gods and goddesses circle in their flying chariots. Above everything, the shimmering Aegis, both offensive and defensive weapon, shimmers and builds its energies. In the no-man's land, beyond the gods, just beyond where the Aegis shimmers, slices into soil and stone, and continues downward, curving in a sphere deep toward the center of Mars, the bodies of the two Cerberids lie. Two-headed dog things, more than 20 feet long, with teeth of chrome steel, and gas chromatograph mass spectrometers in their snouts. The Cerberids sprawl dead, where Achilles and Hector each killed one, upon the hero's arrival at Olympus only hours earlier. 100 feet beyond the Cerberids are the burned remnants of the old Scolic barracks. Beyond the barracks are the armies of humankind, 120,000 strong this evening. Hector's forces are drawn up in ranks and rows on the inland side, 40,000 of Ilium's boldest fighters. Paris has been ordered to stay behind in Ilium, tasked by his older brother with the heavy responsibility of protecting their homes and loved ones in the ancient city, domed now by the Moravec force field, but more securely protected, Hector has said, by bronze spear points and human courage. But the other captains and their contingents are here. Near Hector stands the Trojan supreme commander's trusted brother, Deiphobus, in charge of 10,000 hand-picked spearmen. Nearby is Aeneas, forging his new destiny here, no longer favored by the fates. Behind Aeneas' contingent of fighters is noble Glaucus, at the head of his ranks of chariots and 11,000 wild Lycians, ready to fight. Ascanius from Ascania, co-commander of the Phrygians, is here, the young captain fully clad in bronze and leather and eager for glory. His 4,200 Ascanians are eager to spill immortal ichor if immortal blood is not available. Behind the Trojan fighters, too old and too valued to lead men into combat, but dressed in battle gear this day and ready to die if such is the universe's will, are clustered the kings and counselors of Ilium. First King Priam himself, wearing legendary armor hammered from the metal of an ancient meteor. Then old Antenor, father of many Trojan heroes,
most of whom have already fallen in battle. Near Antenor stand Priam's honored brothers, Lampus and Clytius, and gray-bearded Hicetan, who until this day had honored Ares, the god of war, above all other things. And behind Hicetan, those most respected of Trojan elders, Panthous and Thymoides. Standing with these old men today, eyes always on her husband, dressed in red as if she's become a living banner of blood and loss, is beautiful Andromache, Hector's wife, mother of the murdered Scamandrius, the babe known to the loving residents of Ilium as Astyanax, lord of the city. At the center of this 3-mile-long human battle line, commanding more than 80,000 battle-tested Achaeans, towers Golden Achilles, son of Peleus, killer of men. He is said to be, save for one secret weakness, invulnerable. This evening, in full battle dress and flushed with the superhuman energy of almost inhuman rage, he looks immortal. The spot to Achilles' right has been left empty to honor the memory of his dearest friend and battle comrade, Patroclus, said to have been savagely murdered by Pallas Athena less than 24 hours earlier. Behind and to the right of Achilles is the surprising troika of Agamemnon, Menelaus, and Odysseus. The two sons of Atrides are still bruised from their single combat with Achilles, and Menelaus' left arm is too injured for him to carry a shield, but the two deposed leaders have found it necessary to be with their captains and men on this day. Odysseus, apparently lost in thought, is looking out over the human and immortal battle lines and scratching his beard. Spread through the rest of the Achaean ranks, in chariots and on foot, always at the head of their men, are the surviving Greek heroes of 9 years of bitter war. Diomedes, still dressed in his lion skin and carrying a club larger than most men. Big Ajax, bulwark of the Achaeans, towering over his entire line of warriors, and little Ajax, leading his professional killers from Locris. Within a rock's throw of these heroes stands the great spearman Idomeneus at the head of his legendary Cretan warriors. And nearby, tall in his chariot, Meriones, eager to ride into combat next to Big Ajax's half-brother, the master archer Teucer. On the Achaeans' right flank, nearest the ocean, row upon row of armored men turn their crested helmets to look to their leader and the oldest Achaean captain present this day, wily Nestor, breaker of horses. Nestor has placed himself out ahead of all others there on the right flank, red-caped and visible in his 4-horsed chariot, so he will be the first on this flank to fall, or the first to fight his way through the battle line of the immortals. In nearby chariots, obviously eager to ride into combat with their father, are Nestor's sons, Antilochus, Achilles' good friend, and Antilochus' taller and more handsome brother, Thrasymedes. 100 more captains are here this day, each carrying his proud name and his father's proud name, together leading tens of thousands more men, each of those men holding noble names and complex histories, each man carrying their father's proud names into battle to glory and life, or taking those names down with them to the house of death this day. To the right of the Mastachians, spread out along the shore in no particular order, standing silent and green, are several thousand Zeks, little green men who have poured out of their barges and feluccas and flimsy sailing ships from ocean Tethys and the Valles Marineris inland sea, and who stand witness here this day for reasons known only to themselves and perhaps to their avatar, Prospero, or the unmet god called Setebos. They stand mute along the softly crashing line of surf, and neither the Greeks nor the Trojans nor the immortal gods have yet interfered with them. A 30 miles or so out to sea, behind the Zeks, sails catching the rosy Martian sunset and oars reflecting the golden sea glow, range more than 100 Achaean ships of the line. Now the sails are slackened, the oars are shipped, and shields and spears line the ship's sides. Crests of yellow, red, purple, and blue, and the gleaming tops of helmets are all that can be seen of the more than 3,000 Achaean fighters on those ships. In the space between the masked ships, hinted at now only by their periscopes and the tops of their black metal sails, 3 Belt Moravec ballistic missile submarines cruised through the Martian sea. Spread thinly for 2 miles behind the Trojans and Achaeans on land are massed the Belt Moravec infantry, 27,000 black-armored, beetle-armed ground troops carrying weapons both heavy and light. energy, and ballistic ROCVAC artillery batteries are arrayed as far back as 15 kilometers behind the front lines, their projectors and tubes aimed at Olympus and the massed immortals. Above all the human and Moravec lines, circle and dart 116 Hornet fighter aircraft, some tuned to stealth, others still as boldly black as when first sighted earlier in the day. In orbit overhead, so the Beltmoraveks have reported, are 65 combat spacecraft circling Mars in orbits ranging from just a hair above the Martian atmosphere to several million miles out beyond hurtling Phobos and Deimos. The Beltmoravec military commander on the ground has reported to the European Moravec Monmut, who has translated to Achilles and Hector, that all grades of bombs, missiles, force fields, and energy weapons on all these ships are cocked and locked. The report means nothing to the heroes, and they have disregarded it. On the same flat area near Achilles, to the right of Odysseus and the Atrides, but standing apart, are Monmut, Orfu, and Hockenberry. Monmut had taken one look at the gathering armies earlier in the afternoon, and with the Trojan commander Perimus' help, immediately commandeered a chariot with which to fetch Orfu through the quantum tunnel slice. Dragging the levitated Ionian behind the chariot, in Orfu's own words, like a dinged-up U-Haul trailer. Monmut didn't know what that was exactly. His Lost Age colloquial databanks were not as obsessively overflowing as Orfu's, but he promised himself he'd look it up someday, if he survived. Skolik Thomas Hockenberry, Ph.D., is dressed in a Trojan captain's cape, armor, and clothes, and although he seems thrilled to be witnessing all this, he also appears to have some trouble standing still. While the thousands of warriors up to the level of noble Achilles wait almost motionless for the final stragglers in each army, human and immortal, to assemble, Hockenberry is shuffling from foot to foot. "Something wrong?" whispers Monmut in English. "I think something's crawling in my shorts," Hockenberry whispers back. The armies are assembled. The silence is uncanny. There is no noise from either side except for the slow hiss of distant waves rolling into the pebbled beach, the occasional whinny of a horse harnessed to a battle chariot, the soft sound of Martian breeze through the cliff rocks of Olympus, the air hiss of flying chariots circling and the higher buzz of Hornet fighters, the occasional inadvertent soft clank of bronze on bronze as some soldier shifts position, and the powerful, omnipresent negative sound of tens of thousands of anxious men trying to remember to breathe normally. Zeus steps forward, passing through the aegis like a giant stepping through a rippling waterfall. Achilles walks out into no man's land to face the father of the gods.
"Do you have anything to say before you and your species die?" says Zeus, his tone conversational but so amplified that it carries to the farthest reaches of the field, even to the men on the Greek ships at sea. Achilles pauses, looks over his shoulder at the masses of men behind him, turns back, looks past Zeus toward Olympus and the masses of gods in front of him, and then crooks his neck to look up again at towering Zeus. "Surrender now," says Achilles, "and we'll spare your goddesses' lives so they can be our slaves and courtesans." 64. Artist's Hall. Demon slept for 2 days and 2 nights, waking fitfully only when Ada fed him broth or Odysseus bathed him. He woke again briefly the afternoon that Odysseus shaved him, drawing a straight razor through his lathered beard, but Demon was too tired to speak or listen to language. Nor did the sleeping man pay any attention to the roars in the sky as the meteors returned the next night and then the next. He didn't wake when a small bit of something traveling several thousand miles per hour plowed into the field behind the house, exactly where Odysseus had taught for weeks. The impact excavated a crater 15 feet across and 9 feet deep, and broke every remaining window on Artis Hall. Demon awoke mid-morning of the third day. Ada was sitting on the edge of his bed, her bed, it turned out, and Odysseus was leaning against the door frame, arms crossed. "Welcome back, Demon Ur," Ada said softly. "Thank you, Ada Ur," said Demon. His voice was hoarse, and it seemed to him that he had to use an inordinate amount of energy just to croak a few words. "Harmon? Hannah?" "Both better," said Ada. Demon had never noticed how perfectly green the young woman's eyes were.
Harmon is out of bed and downstairs eating this morning, and Hannah is learning to walk again. Right now she's on the front lawn in the sun.
Demon nodded and closed his eyes. He had the overwhelming urge to keep them closed and to drift back into dreams and sleep. It hurt less there, and right now his right arm ached and burned terribly. Suddenly he opened his eyes and pulled the covers off that arm, filled with a terrible certainty that they had amputated the limb while he slept, and that all he was feeling was phantom pain from a phantom limb. The arm was red, swollen, scarred, the wound from Caliban's terrible bite stitched together with heavy thread, but the arm was there. Demon tried to move it to wiggle his fingers. The pain made him gasp, but the fingers had moved. The arm had lifted a bit. He dropped it back onto the sheet and gasped for a while.
"Who did that?" he asked a moment later. "The stitches? Servitors?"
Odysseus walked closer to the bed. "I did the stitching," said the barrel-chested barbarian.
"The servitors don't work anymore," said Ada, "anywhere. The fax nodes still operate, so we're hearing from everywhere. Servitors out of order. The Voynich's gone."
Demon frowned at this, trying to understand and failing. Harmon entered the room, using a walking stick as a cane. Demon saw that the older man had kept his beard, although it looked as if he'd trimmed it. He sat on a chair next to the bed and gripped Demon's left arm. Demon closed his eyes for a minute and just returned the tight grip. When he opened his eyes, they were watering. Fatigue, he thought.
"The meteor storm is letting up, a little less fierce each evening," said Harmon. "But there have been casualties, deaths. More than 100 people died in Ulaanbaatar alone."
"Deaths?" repeated Demon. The word had not held real meaning for a long, long time.
"You people had to learn about burials again from scratch," said Odysseus. "No faxing up to a happy eternity as immortal post-humans in the E and P rings any longer. People are burying their dead and trying to tend to the injured."
"Paris Crater?" managed Demon. "My mother?"
"She's well," said Ada. "That city wasn't hit. We have runners coming every day with news. She sent a letter, Demon. She's afraid to fax until things settle down. A lot of people are. With servitors and Voynich's gone and the power off everywhere, most people don't want to travel unless they absolutely have to."
Demon nodded. "Why is the power off but the fax nodes still working? Where are the Voynich's? What's going on?"
"We don't know," said Harmon. "But the meteor shower didn't include, what did Prospero call it, a species extinction event. We can be glad for that."
"Yes," said Demon, but what he was thinking was, so Prospero and Caliban and Savi's death were real. It wasn't all a dream.
He moved his right arm again and the pain answered the question.
Hannah came in wearing a simple white shift. There seemed to be a slight fuzz on her scalp. Her face looked more human and alive in every way. She moved to Demon's bedside, took care not to touch his arm, and bent over and kissed him firmly on the lips.
"Thank you, Demon. Thank you," she said, when the kiss was finished. She handed him a tiny forget-me-not she'd picked in the yard, and he took it clumsily in his left hand.
"You're welcome," said Demon.
"I liked that kiss." He had. It was as if he, Demon, the world's most eager womanizer, had never been kissed before.
"This is interesting," said Hannah, unballing a Terran cloth from her other hand. "I found it down by the old oak table, but it doesn't work anymore. I tried two others, nothing. Even the Terrans don't work now."
"Or maybe the Greek and Trojan battle drama is finished," said Harmon, holding the embroidered circuits on the cloth to his forehead and then tossing the cloth aside. "Perhaps the Terrans' story is over."
Odysseus was looking out the window at the blue sky and green lawn, but now he turned back toward the little gathering.
"I don't think so," he said. "I suspect that the real war has just begun."
"Do you know anything about the Turin drama?" asked Hannah. "I thought you said you never went under the cloth."
Odysseus shrugged. "Savi and I distributed the Turin cloths almost 10 years ago. I brought the prototype from far away."
"Why?" asked Demon.
Odysseus opened his hand. "The war was coming. Human beings here on Earth had to learn something about war, its terror, and its beauty. And they had to learn something about those people in the tale, Achilles, Hector, the others, even me."
"Why?" asked Hannah.
"Because the war is coming," said Odysseus.
"We're not a part of it," said Ada.
Odysseus folded his arms. "You will be." You're not on the front lines yet, but those battle lines are coming this way. You'll be part of this conflict whether you want to be or not. How can we take part, asked Ada. We don't know how to fight or even want to learn how. About 60 of the young men and women who've stayed here will know a bit about fighting in a few weeks' time, said Odysseus. Whether they want to fight when the time comes will be up to them, as it always is. He pointed to Harmon. Believe it or not, your Sony's fixable. I've been working on it and may have it in the air in a week or 10 days. I don't want to see fighting, said Ada. I don't want to be in a war. No, said Odysseus, you're right not to. Ada lowered her face as if to fight back tears. When she put her closed hand on the bed, Demon set his fingers next to hers and handed her Hannah's forget-me-not. Then he drifted off to sleep. He awoke in darkness and moonlight with a shape sitting next to the bed. Caliban. Demon instinctively lifted his right arm, folding his right hand into a fist, and the pain set off lights behind his eyes. Easy, said Harmon, leaning across him to straighten the bandaged arm. Easy, Demon. Demon was gasping, trying not to vomit from the pain. I thought you were... I know, said Harmon. Demon sat up in bed. Do you think he's dead? The shadow man shook his head. I don't know. I've been wondering, thinking about it, about both of them. Both of them, said Demon. You mean Savi as well? No, I mean... Yes, I think about her a lot, but I was thinking about Prospero. The hologram of Prospero, who said it was only an echo of a shadow or whatever. What about it? I think it was Prospero, whispered Harmon. He leaned closer. I think he was imprisoned somehow on the post-humans asteroid city, what the Prospero holo called my isle, just as Caliban was imprisoned there. By whom? Said Demon. Harmon sat back and sighed. I don't know. These days I don't know a damned thing. Demon nodded. It took us a long time to learn enough to realize that none of us knows a damned thing, didn't it, Harmon? The older man laughed. But when he spoke again, his whispered tone was serious. I'm worried that we freed them. Freed them? Whispered Demon. He'd been hungry a second before, ravenous, but now his belly felt filled with ice water. Caliban and Prospero? Yes. Well, maybe we killed them, said Demon, voice hard. Yes. Harmon rose and clasped the younger man's shoulder. I'm going to go and let you get some sleep. Thank you, Demon. For what? Thank you, repeated Harmon. He left the room. Demon lay back on the pillows, exhausted, but sleep didn't come. He listened to night sounds coming through the broken window, crickets, night birds he couldn't name, frogs croaking in the small pond behind the house, the rustle of leaves in the night breeze, and he found that he was grinning. If Caliban's alive, it's a damned shame. But I'm alive as well. I'm alive. He slept then, a clean and dreamless sleep that lasted until Ada awoke him an hour after dawn with his first real breakfast in 5 weeks. 4 days later, and Demon was walking in the gardens alone on a cool but beautiful evening when Ada, Harmon, Hannah, Odysseus, Pater, and the young woman named Paine came down the hill to find him. The Sony's fixed, said Odysseus, or at least it can fly. Want to watch its test flight? Demon shrugged. Not especially, but I do want to know what you're going to do with it. End of side 17.